Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 136 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I am Sarah Kamen.
In studio today, Mr. Brian Leventhal, CEO and co-founder of Brooklyn Winery. Brian, welcome to The Morning After.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to ask you about all things making wine in Brooklyn after the break.
Awesome.
Sari, yes. Later in the show, we're going to do a little Morning After quiz on Brian.
I can't wait.
He doesn't know the topic yet. I think it's better that way.
I think so.
Don't give it up.
I like it like that.
But you have some food news for us.
Indeed, I do. I do. It's been a big week. First of all, starting off, I don't know how many of you remember our old friend Marilyn Haggerty of the Olive Garden Review fame coming out of Grand Forks. She wrote an article, or a review rather, of
don't
Olive Garden.
Don't confuse those, yeah.
No, that was not an article by any stretch of the imagination. She wrote a review of her local Olive Garden.
Was it on Yelp?
It was actually not even remotely on Yelp. It was on the Grand Forks Herald.
Okay, big paper. So it does sound like an article.
It was a legitimate review, and she had some really interesting critiques. And for whatever reason, her review went viral, and she became a total superstar, rivaling Frank Bruni and other greats.
For good reason.
For good reason. And then she had another review, and it was great. And she is back, and we are so excited. She has reviewed this time McDonald's.
No.
Because, my God, it's about what? Time someone has reviewed McDonald's. And, you know, I'm going to say she had mixed reactions. There were high points and low
she
points.
She had mixed.
I want to read my favorite paragraph. she speaks to the lattes, which everyone knows, you know.
McDonald's has lattes? This is how long it's been.
Yeah. So she writes, she's genius. The lattes cost less than those I enjoy at Starbucks, but they are worthy. The only problem is occasionally one of the restaurants will tell you their machine is not working. Not working, I think. I almost foam at the mouth in disgust, but I try to be pleasant. And you know what, Marilyn? We love you for that. We appreciate your pleasantries.
Foaming at the mouth in disgust is totally worth it at McDonald's. Like
she might be rabid.
I'm sure that the person taking care of her, the person at the counter, is doing the exact same
thing. She might need a doctor.
Oh, God.
So she's really famous. And apparently Anthony Bourdain, she has a book coming out. They have a book with all of her reviews compiled. And Anthony Bourdain wrote the foreword.
What?
He writes, this is a straightforward account of what people have been eating, still are eating, and much of America, as related by a kind, good-hearted reporter looking to pass along as much useful information as she can while hurting no one. Which is so ironic that it comes from Anthony Bourdain, who, like, lives to rip people holes in their butt.
That entire foreword was him dancing around the fact that she's reviewing crappy, awful food.
And yet he agreed to write it. It's like he was at home, like, drinking chamomile tea and stroking his cat while he wrote that.
Yeah, he must be getting nicer in his old age and
he
fame.
He is really getting soft, and I, for one, am not having it. Mm-mm. Moving on, I think the big story of this weekend is that Sky Mall has declared bankruptcy.
Oh,
I'm sure you've heard.
Yeah, I don't know where I'm going to get my elevated dog beds.
Exactly. Have you heard, Brian?
Yeah,
feelings,
that
emotions.
That was always something I would look forward to when I'd go on the plane. It would pass about 25 to 45 minutes of my time.
At least 27 minutes of my time.
Absolutely.
What am I going to do now?
They're always like the staples that were in every single issue, but then I always loved like the Hammacher Schlemmer section personally.
Oh yeah, like the really luxe section.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any favorites that you recall at this point? Nope, I do. Okay, a pina colada scented women's t-shirt. Yes. It smells like piña colada.
Well, when you're on your way to a tropical vacation.
Or make your own. Stay at home. Lick yourself. Or, I don't care.
Or do what I do. Spill things on yourself.
What if you spilled a piña colada on your piña colada t-shirt? It's so meta. A high heel shoe wine holder.
Ooh.
Because if you put your wine in a real shoe, that'd be gross.
Is it a wine glass or a wine bottle?
It's a wine bottle holder that looks like a high heel. Everyone needs that.
So I've actually bought something from SkyMall.
You have. You're the one.
Yes, I have. Actually,
you're the one that kept it in business all these years.
I've actually bought it the same thing twice.
What is it?
So it's a white noise generator that I use before to go to sleep with. And I bought it. The reason why I bought it originally was actually I bought the first time about 15 years ago, because my college roommate my freshman year was like one of these night owls. And I, you're in a tiny little freshman dorm, and I like to go to sleep earlier. So to try to like block out all of his rustling, I bought this thing when I was on the plane to St. Louis, where I went to school. And then it lasted for about like 12 years, I'd say. And I just gotten so used to using it even after college that I had to buy another one. And the only place I knew where they sold it is SkyMall. But I did buy it on SkyMall.com.
Which
I
guess you're screwed now.
So I got hopefully another 8-10 years out of this. And I don't know what I'm
going to do. Maybe you should buy one now.
or maybe you should do what this other guy is doing, which is starting an Indiegogo campaign to save SkyMall.
Are they not having like some type of big clearance sale or something? Like, is everything on a discount or something?
Not as of last time I checked, which was about 4 minutes ago. So there's a guy who feels really strongly that SkyMall should sustain itself, and he's going to contribute. So he started an Indiegogo campaign. He thinks that it will cost $1,015,000.
What's that random extra 15 for?
I don't know. And so far he's raised
$2.
$2.
That's it.
Mm. I mean, yeah. I'm sorry, guys, but I say let it die.
Yeah.
It's like that song in Frozen that I shall not sing.
Let it die.
Let it die. That one.
What I remember from SkyMall is mostly the lawn ornaments or the garden things, like where there's like a zombie body coming out of the garden or something, and that seemed really relevant.
Yeah.
But yeah. Also, yeah. Not for Christmas time. Kind of for
so many memories. So many feelings. Okay, well, feel free to contribute to some guy's Indiegogo campaign if you feel strongly about this issue. Although, I think he's probably going to pocket the $2. Moving on. We all know that there is a cat cafe that now exists.
Boy. Yes. Must we speak of it again?
No, we're not going to speak of it, because it's just a segue this time to let you know that, speaking of Indiegogo campaigns, there is one for the United States' first dog cafe.
Yes.
Yes, I say. Screw those cats and their cups of tea. I love dogs, but I'm not going to give to this one because it's in LA. So they're hoping to net 200,000 by February 5th. They predict that, or project rather, that the dog cafe needs a lot more money than the cat cafe because they need a lot more space because dogs like to run around.
I wonder if they checked the health code.
Of course she did. Yeah, she's no amateur, this one Sarah Wolfgang. And she writes on Indiegogo, it's going to be a coffee shop where you'll be completely surrounded by dogs. Small, big, quiet, crazy, young, old, all sorts of dogs. It will cover cups of coffee and tea. Food is apparently out since it makes dogs territorial. In an environment flanked by fully adoptable canines rescued from shelters.
Okay, so you're just going to be, like, high on caffeine with dogs, like, jumping around you? That sounds like the most, like, panic attack-inducing thing ever for me.
Sounds like heaven to me.
Sounds like heaven for you? Really?
Yeah.
Have you ever, like, been around a dog in a cup of coffee? Like,
obviously.
Tail, like, you can't put it on a table.
Well, don't give the dog the coffee.
No, I mean, like, you know, they're unpredictable. They're like, you can't put it on a coffee table because they'll knock it over. You can't, like, hold it in your hand because they'll jump and knock it. I don't see just in general how food and animals go together, unless you're eating them.
Oh my God, this guy's really excited. He just noticed we exist right outside the window. Here, we're here at Roberta's, and there's a guy outside, and he just realized he can see into us. see into our station.
It's kind of creepy. You just kind of stare and watch people eat and drink right in front of you.
He's yelling, there's a radio station. We're on the air, dude. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's it. You bursted my my dreams once again, Jesse Kiefer.
And what he doesn't know is that he's listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. We're going to take a break.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
It is a brave thing to open a restaurant in New York City, but it is downright crazy to open a winery. I mean, where's the space going to come from? Well, our guest in studio today did just that. He is the co-founder and CEO of Brooklyn Winery in, well, you guessed it, Brooklyn. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you very much.
So I want to know, how did the idea for Brooklyn Winery kind of just get started? How'd the seed get planted?
Sure. So Brooklyn Winery started almost about 4.5 years ago now, but the idea was about over 5 years ago. And my business partner, John Stiers, and I, we used to work together in a tech startup in Manhattan, totally unrelated to wine. And while we were there, one of our coworkers, she actually, she lived in New Jersey, and one day she was driving down the road and saw this sign on the road that said, make your own wine. And she comes back to the office, and it's a small office. There are like maybe only 15 of us that work there. And she's like, who wants to make their own wine with me in New Jersey? And I'm like, okay.
You're like, what? I'm sorry.
I was
with
you until New Jersey.
So, and you have to, like, none of us own cars or anything, right? So getting to New Jersey from New York City is, it's quite a challenging feat, to be totally honest. But for me, it was like, you know what, it's a fun thing to do, go out there. I liked wine, but I didn't know, like, very much about it, to be honest. And so there were probably about 8 of us from the office that decided, let's do this. And if there was, this was in Wallington, New Jersey. So go figure.
I have right? no idea where that
no
is.
Never
idea.
Heard of it. It's irrelevant, sense. Right? It's just, all I can tell you is it's extremely challenging to get to if you don't have a car. It required numerous forms of mass transportation that connected together. But when you hear in a second, that's part of why Brooklyn Winery started. So went out there, and actually it was very like mom and pop run. They brought in some basic fruit from Central Coast, California, and had very rudimentary winemaking equipment, but they kind of like walked you through the very basic elements of how to make wine. And you went there probably about 4 or 5 times over the course of a year. And at the end of the year, regardless if your wine was ready or not, you took it home because they needed to reuse the barrels for the following year. But we actually did this as a group for about 3 years. And, you know, the wine was good because you made it. I don't know if other people would necessarily say the wine was good, but
it's just like your children.
Exactly.
You love them all 100%. The same.
And I was always look forward to like bringing it home Thanksgiving when I had the whole family there. Like, this was the wine I made this past year.
Was your family like, yay, your wine again?
We have to drink this
Wait,
stuff
really?
Again.
Really? They were?
Aww. But anyway, so we did this for a while, and then John and I, and we still don't know who actually really was the one who actually took full credit for the idea, but one day we were sitting at a bar, and we were like, yo, like, why doesn't something like this actually exist in New York City.
With the idea of, like, where you can go and make your own
wine. Yes, exactly. And that was like, oh my God, like, if we're schlepping out to New Jersey and going through this craziness to do this, and we're having a fun time, can't we do this in New York?
You're like, wait, we don't have to go to New Jersey?
Exactly. Like, and we were like, we're normal enough people. Like, there's got to be other people like us that would enjoy doing this.
I just love that you have started a business so you don't have to go out to New Jersey.
I'm telling you, totally the legitimate fact that it was such a horrible trip only furthered the idea to actually make it happen. I really truly believe that.
That's motivation.
So we, it's kind of the classic entrepreneur story. So we kind of had this idea. We weren't totally thrilled with our jobs at the time. So we really, like, once this idea is kind of seated in your head, it's the only thing you can think about. So we just, like, started independently, even, like, separately working on it and just gathering information that we kind of grouped up and kind of started to develop like a plan, like, all right, like, let's actually like flush this out. We started doing a lot of research, like, legally, could we even do this? Like, what's the business model of a winery and like, how do you do it in New York City? And it all actually started to come together relatively quickly.
And then at what point did you quit your job?
Yeah,
so you could do it full time.
I'll just give you the timeline. We came up with this crazy idea August 2009 and we actually quit our jobs at the end of January 2010.
Wow.
So very, very quickly, because we kind of hit that point where it's like, are we doing this or are we not? And it was one of the most challenging, scary decisions we ever had to make because there really was like, we're just quitting. Like, we didn't have any money guaranteed to us. We literally had an idea that we thought was fleshed out that we had written on paper. That was about it. And we had a space that we saw that we thought would work, but weren't even close to like negotiating a lease or anything.
And is that the space you're in now?
It is, yeah.
Wow.
So the first, was this the first space you looked at?
We looked at a lot. So we looked at, we basically looked at two different neighborhoods primarily. So when it came to the business that we were opening, we needed it to be, there's actually all these zoning requirements because winemaking is actually manufacturing. And then we wanted to have a commercial component as well where people can go. And
the money component.
Exactly. Because if you're just going to manufacture in New York City, it is going to be very, very expensive rent to do that. So the two neighborhoods that lent itself for this were Gowanus and Williamsburg. And there were still parts of Williamsburg that were zoned for mixed use. So they rezoned Brooklyn in 2006 to allow for all the residential. So a lot of this pre-existing manufacturing space, they actually changed the zoning on, and that spurred all these high rises and big buildings that you're seeing, especially in North Brooklyn right now.
Mm-hmm.
And but there were still pockets that they kind of maintained this mixed use, meaning you could do manufacturing and commercial and residential all within the same unit. The manufacturing had to be what's like kind of quote light manufacturing. It can't be like heavy, like that causes chemicals and smells and everything. But winemaking was classified under kind of that lighter manufacturing. And it's so funny. It's so like street by street focused that literally on where we are in North 8th Street, if you went to the south side of the street directly across the street from where we are, we would not have been allowed to open our business.
That's
nuts. How like crazy the zoning is. So when we saw that space, it was a great size. It was like 8,000 square
it's
feet.
It's really big.
It's a big space. And the funny thing is when we were looking at it, we're like, we were originally looking at spaces that were closer to like 5,000. We're like, God, this is too big. This is more than we need. And it was like, now we're in the shoes. We're like, God, I wish I had more
space.
Yeah,
you're busting out of it.
Busting
now.
At the seams. So, but anyway, like that's, and then we, it kind of all came together quickly. So we had three major things we had to do once we quit our jobs that all were reliant on each other. And this is kind of the crazy, like, management of information game where we needed to get this space and get a lease signed. We needed to raise capital and we needed to find a winemaker. And it's space requires money, right? A landlord's not going to take you on unless you have money. In order to get money, they want to make sure that you have a space and that you have a winemaker because that's the key employee for the operation. I was not relying on my rudimentary background from my New Jersey experience. And then
thank God.
To get a winemaker, especially a very talented one, it's not a local job. So I'm interviewing people that were going to have to relocate themselves a lot from obviously the most winemakers out there from California. And so they want to come knowing that this is for real, that there's a space and that there's money to do this. So how do you have all these forces happen simultaneously? And that was from when we quit our jobs to when we actually signed that lease, which was about 4 months later. It was the craziest 4 months of our life.
I can only imagine. So when you, most people should know that, you know, wine doesn't just happen overnight. So you guys had to open with wine that wasn't wine that you were making.
Correct. So from when we signed that lease, which was June, to when we actually opened our doors, which was early fall, around October, we realized we needed to have a place to actually drive some money. So we opened with this client experience. People make your own wine, just like the experience that we were having in New Jersey. But also we had a wine bar where people can come in and drink some wines and eat some food. Obviously, it was not wines that we had produced yet because we it takes at least 1 to 2 years at the minimum to produce wine. So we did have a list at the very beginning that was it was curated by our winemaker. And it was just a kind of a really nice standard wine list.
Did you have a chef at that point?
So we didn't. Okay. It was really interesting. We were going so fast to gut renovate this space, get the winery open, that we didn't, and John and I were not restaurant people at all. Like, literally the most restaurant experience between the two of us was John waited tables at a country club like 10 years earlier. I hadn't even worked in a restaurant in my life. So,
but you had been to one.
I've been to a few. So anyway, we didn't realize how important food was when we were open, and we just didn't have the bandwidth to begin our own food program. So right when we opened, actually for a brief moment, we did a partnership with a local food purveyor that actually no longer exists, but they were like a Williamsburg high-end to-go place that we were like, this was a good opportunity for them to expand. And they actually built their original menu and supplied a cook to cook it. And within probably 6 weeks, I realized how food is super important, and I can't have this be on someone else's, like, someone, I can't open a business and then have a huge portion of the business be run by someone that's not part of my company. Mm-hmm. So I parted ways and built the food program basically just like 2 months after we opened.
So I want to talk about your winemaker, Connor McCormick, for a minute.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty blown away to find out that he had this pretty illustrious career happening in California as a winemaker. He'd worked at several vineyards, had this kind of idyllic life, you know, out there harvesting grapes, picking grapes in the California sunshine. Mm-hmm. And he packed up his entire life and moved to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Like one of the most urban, gritty areas of Brooklyn, New York, to continue his winemaking career.
So this first hire of getting a winemaker was critical for not only for the person to be talented, but to be the right fit. Because we look at this as like, and we kind of make the analogy, this is like our Garrett Oliver. You know, like Brooklyn Breweries had Garrett Oliver as their brewmaster for 20 plus years. He's been with them. He's part of the face of the company. We wanted that where someone that we can trust, and actually who makes a great product, but and gets along with us really well. So Connor, he was actually, he's a city guy. So you need, a big part of our criteria was like someone that actually enjoys living in a city and isn't someone where if they came to New York for the first time would just be completely out of their element. So Connor lived in San Francisco.
Yeah, because I was going to say many winemakers, people don't always think of this, but many winemakers are farmers, or many winemakers
Absolutely.
Are like country people who want to be out in open spaces and not in the city.
And we were interviewing a few people actually before we even interviewed Connor for the first time who were much more in that camp, that were much more, you know, rural type winemakers. And we just weren't confident that they would be able to do this in an urban environment and deal with all the constraints. So when we hired Connor, he was actually working for a business called Crush Pad, which no longer exists anymore, but it was kind of on the forefront of urban wineries. Crush Pad was a monstrous operation based in San Francisco, where they actually did a lot of client-based winemaking, small lots, in an urban environment where they were sourcing fruit from a lot of vineyards within Northern California and Washington and Oregon. And he was basically leading the entire production team within CrushPad. So there could not have been a more perfect person for our business model that we had here. He wasn't, though, like, there were still people more senior than Connor there, and there were a lot of issues with the business, hence part of the reason why they no longer exist. So for him to come, start something from scratch, build it out the way that he wants, which is super critical with wineries, because things as simple as drainage and how floors slope is something that can actually impact a winemaker's life and livelihood. So if you're constantly squeegeeing all day because water puddles on the floor, you are miserable. Mm-hmm. So things as simple as like that and building it out the right way, getting the right equipment, and then starting something from the ground up was really, really appealing to him. And he was the perfect fit for us.
So I think people will think Brooklyn. There aren't any vineyards nearby.
No.
So, I mean, there are vineyards not that far away, you know, generally speaking, meaning Long Island or the Finger Lakes. So where is the majority of your fruit coming from?
Sure. So we bring about 2/3 of our grapes in from New York State. We focus on New York first as much as we can. So we New York has actually the third largest producer of wine in the country after California and Washington.
Wine grapes, yeah.
Wine grapes. So we do try to focus on what New York does best. And there's two regions we like the most, which are the Finger Lakes, which is up north, northwest of New York, as well as the east end of Long Island. And we bring in 100% of our white wine varietals from the Finger Lakes. It's an amazing, cool climate for white wine grapes, such as Chardonnay, Riesling, Gewürztraminer. The east end of Long Island, we found, does well with some of the Bordeaux varietals, especially Merlot, Cabernet Franc. In a good year, which like 2013 was a spectacular year for New York, we brought in Cabernet Sauvignon and even Petit Verdot. It had the ability to ripen. But there are numerous grapes that New York just doesn't have the growing climate for, or there's too much rain or whatever the reasons. And we do want to have this vast portfolio since we're not tied to a specific grape growing region. Since we're in Brooklyn, we feel like we do have the right to bring grapes in from other parts of the country. And we do focus on Northern California. And this year, we actually also brought fruit in from Washington and Oregon. And the varietals that we bring in from out there are Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Zinfandel. This year, we brought in a little Grenache. We're bringing in Syrah, which we're drinking now, a little Malbec. So some of those other red varietals, which we just can't really grow at the level of quality that we'd like in New York State, we will bring in from California.
I want to know, because much of winemaking is not just about the fruit, but it's about the winery itself.
100%.
And when it comes to the terroir of your winery in Brooklyn, you know, what sort of challenges have you had? Because again, if your winery is out, you know, in the country, you're going to have a lot less pollution, a lot less kind of everything in your way.
So it sounds obvious, but the number one challenge is space. Mm-hmm. It'll be, if you ask our winemaker, he'll instantly say that. We call it a game of Tetris, where we just don't have we want all our wine to be in the perfect quality. So quality is most important, starting with the grapes. But when it actually gets to the winery itself, we have a fully temperature controlled barrel room. So we could store the barrels in a non-temperature controlled room, but we don't do that. But it's always juggling things around. Getting deliveries to the winery in 18-wheel trucks down narrow Brooklyn streets, we don't have a loading dock, so we literally are driving forklifts down the street carrying thousands of pounds of grapes, and who knows what else is going on the street at the time. So that's been a huge challenge. The winemaking itself, from what Connor has told us and what I've seen, is pretty similar. Like, we have all the equipment, so as long as we can get the grapes there, which we have great logistics in place to do so, we can make great wine.
That's great to know, because I would imagine that you would have other, you know, other issues going on. So I guess this might be a little bit too geeky, and please like stop me when you need to, sorry.
Let's geek it out.
But
go, girl.
I mean, it's not geeky, but it just may be advanced. So are you, the fruit from California is being sent to you whole cluster?
Yep. So we...
okay, I know because, what that means.
Well, no, I just mean because, you know, you could be pressing the juice in California and then bringing it back to California versus bringing the fruit back because, I mean, I would imagine that's more risk.
This was a huge decision we had to make. The simple, cheaper way would be to have the grapes pressed out, meaning the juice would be squeezed out from the grapes out in California and then ship this juice. Obviously, it would condense down into smaller containers. It would be cheaper to bring across the country. The problem is there's so much that happens in the winemaking process between when those grapes arrive and the process to destem them, ferment them, and all that. So we bring everything out as completely fresh fruit. It's all hand harvested in the vineyard, so we don't use any machines. Everything is picked into small, they're called champagne lugs. They're basically boxes that hold about 36 pounds of grapes that stack. They go onto pallets. They're brought to a facility out there that chills the pallets. It's never frozen. So it goes down to about 34 degrees Fahrenheit, goes straight onto a refrigerated truck. Sometimes it's actually a tandem truck driver system where there's more than one driver. And that chain of cold never breaks. So that fruit actually arrives around to us 4 or 5 days since it was picked in absolutely perfect form. And we pay more money for it, but it really dictates the quality of the wine.
No, absolutely. I mean, because the fruit essentially could kind of start fermenting on its own 100%. if it was
exactly
warmer. So do you have to factor in that price to the wine that you sell at the winery? Because you're not only paying to keep that at that cold temperature, you're paying to bring it across the country, which that's definitely got to be a serious price point.
Right. And this, let me just take a quick second to note that the original business model we talked about with the client making stuff, just for listeners that are not as familiar with Brooklyn Winery, no longer exists.
And, yeah, I actually was going to
because
to touch
this kind of
that.
Goes
be
this
hard.
This kind of goes to your question. We actually learned pretty quickly that even though we were having this amazing experience in New Jersey, that it was actually a challenging program to have, especially from a logistics perspective. Production is hard to start and stop for groups of people, and we're dealing a lot with Mother Nature. So you have people, the grapes, you don't know exactly the exact day it's going to arrive. So you had groups get planned to come in one day and then they're going to come the next day and ask a group of 10 New Yorkers to change their calendar is virtually impossible. So we actually decided to move away from that model and make everything under the Brooklyn Winery label. And the way that we sell the wine is not only through the wine bar we have at the winery, but we also have, we actually moved pretty substantially into the events business. And the space just kind of lent itself to having large-scale private events. And being able to use that as a way to sell the wine allows us to bring in fruit that is expensive, that has logistics that cost money, because we're now situated in New York City, which is every winery's dream to penetrate, and we have a location where we can sell it at a by the glass or an event price point. So that allows us to really serve wine that would no other venue could be served in that type of format.
Hmm. Brian, I'm really glad you brought up the functionality of the winery, because I did kind of want to shift back to the space as a whole and all its different uses. So I know you guys do private events. You have this wonderful bar where people just love to go and hang out and sometimes eat dinner, sit at the bar, have some wine, have a flight, do an appetizer or make it a whole meal. You have an event coming up for the Oscars. Can you just talk a little about all the, you know, the versatility of the winery?
Yeah, the winery itself, we got blessed we took the space we took because it...
Hashtag blessed.
Exactly. The winery is kind of the backbone of the space. It sits in the background, but there's actually a lot of rooms that surround the winery itself. And where the space is versatile, where you can have the wine bar open, and there's actually there's spaces that are adjacent to the main bar that can be used for a private function. Or if there's a very large-scale event, we will close the winery, the whole space down, and host those events. So we on the weekends, we actually do a lot of weddings. We become, it's really actually become a pretty substantial part of our business. And we love it. We embrace it.
Well, the space is actually gorgeous.
Yeah, the space is designed with all reclaimed wood and antique stuff.
Yeah, it's got that like barn house.
Totally.
Farmhouse? Farmhouse?
Farmhouse. Or barn.
Yep.
everything has a story. Like, we found things in different places, and it's very warm. People feel like it's their home, and, like, they want to, like, spend a lot of time there. It's, like, cozying up, like, near a fireplace type feeling. And I think that's why people started inquiring about events, where it was really never, like, a huge part of the business model. And then we were kind of like, oh, you know what? The space actually really lends itself for that. And instead of kind of like, no, this is our business, this is what we set out to do, we're like, you know what? Let's actually listen to the market and actually kind of adapt our business to what people want. And it's not going to change the fact that we make great wine. It's just a different purpose for what we're going to use it for.
Yeah. So I totally agree with you. As someone who's been running a restaurant for the last 2.5 years, I know that events pay the bills in such a great way. What other things have you realized, you know, really, I guess I want to know, like, yeah, what other things have you realized really work for the space and for the winery that you didn't think of at all before?
Or what, and also on that, like, what doesn't work that you initially had foreseen as a possibility?
So it's very good questions.
Too many.
No.
We take the approach. We like to try a lot of things, but then if something doesn't work, don't do it again and keep doing things that do work. So when we opened the first year or two, we were like, we need to just do anything to get people into the space. This is probably like a lot of restaurants and bars. Like, it's like they'll try anything to get people there. So at the beginning, we did a lot of things that I would say are a little off brand and don't really make as much sense. So we did things like, we did a lot of trivia nights, which are fine and fun, but if you come into the winery now, you'd like, how did they have a trivia night here? We actually did live music in our wine bar on Friday nights at the very beginning that drew some people in, but it also took up two tables. And I have four long farm tables, basically. And by having a band in, it really kind of ate up half my space. We did things where we would try to like sell tickets, and we realized at the beginning, we just didn't have a large enough base to like sell tickets. And we would just stress constantly, oh my God, we only have 8 tickets to this class or this event. And we're like, you know what? Like, it's better if we keep the bar open. We start to build a regular following. We instituted what we call a reserve program, which is like a way for people to earn loyalty and free bottles of wine by coming back. And if someone wants to fill the other rooms as opposed to like us selling tickets, let someone just rent it out, pay us, and they bring their people. And it just ended up working a lot better and taking a lot of the stress out of us.
Is there a reoccurring event now that you guys are kind of, you know, it's like your signature event or something you look forward to?
We do have... So it's like to do no events like would just kind of get boring. So there are a few things that we do. So a couple of parties we throw each year. We do our rosé party, which we do with the release of our rosés, which is kind of like our kickoff to the summer, which is a really fun party. We host an unbelievable New Year's Eve party every year. And another party, we do something pretty cool. It's called the Brooklyn Nouveau Party, where we take a play off of Beaujolais Nouveau. Which is this really cool celebration of the end of harvest where you take grapes that are harvested literally 2 months earlier, and there's this crazy, geeky way to make the wine. It's used a method called carbonic maceration where you can literally make a really fun, fruity, drinkable wine in a very short period of time. And it's done in this region of France called Beaujolais, and it's the third Thursday in November every year. People probably know that Beaujolais wines come out. So we actually do our own version of Beaujolais with some of the grapes that we get, and then we just make enough for this one party. We do it on that third Thursday in November, and it's a total blast. So that's something we've done actually every year since we've started.
I was actually lucky enough to be there this past year.
What did you think of the wine?
Well, I thought it was delicious, and I agree. It was extremely drinkable.
Typically in Beaujolais, it's done with Gamay. That's the grape, but Gamay is really not grown all that much in the United States. So what you need a very thin-skinned grape, which Gamay is. And the closest one that we bring in that works is actually Zinfandel.
Yeah,
So it's a white Zin party.
No, it's not white. It's red.
No, I know, but like a rosé Zin. Okay. I'm thinking like... It's, you're right.
It's great.
I would not go to a white Zin party. I just want to say that.
Listen, white Zin is just rosé. No, but I misspoke. I think it's, you know, it's like a really great idea because, you know, again, you said wine takes like 1 to 2 years to send out. So it's very smart to be able to send out a wine.
Yeah.
Two months after harvest.
I will say I've never been to like a so-called company party with that much love in the room. You guys were basically all making out with each other all night long. Not for real, but much love. It was great.
We take it as an opportunity to really thank everyone. So I do get on the microphone, which I enjoy, and I do give the kudos to everyone, because the winery at this point is certainly... It runs because of the abilities of all my employees, and it's a great time to let everyone know, even like in a more public environment, that they're doing a great job.
It was actually really wonderful to witness, and it warmed my heart.
Well, thank you.
Or maybe it was the wine, but I think it was both.
A little of both.
So I asked you earlier before we were on air about sparkling wine, and are you guys doing that? Because that takes a whole other set of equipment and skill. And you said not yet.
Well, we are making it. It is not released yet. So we are experimenting. Well, I guess it's beyond an experiment. Our first run is going to be a 2013. It's going to be a vintage Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine with grapes, Chardonnay grapes from the Finger Lakes, which lend themselves perfectly, we think, to a sparkling. So we picked them a little bit earlier, because when you make sparkling wine, you don't want there to be as much sugar, because you're actually going to re-ferment the wine later on and add more sugar to it to increase the alcohol. But we are doing it off... we don't have space in our facility, so we are doing it off-site, but we are fully in charge of the operation. And we're doing the full Méthode Champenoise, so all of the wine is actually in the bottle, doing the...
Re-fermenting
in the bottle. It's a... Talking to our winemaker, so 2013 was our first year. We've already started the 2014, but the 2013 won't be ready... Earliest, we're looking at spring of 2016. So it's like close to like a 3-year process to do it the right way. And we're probably going to release it in like batches, so that some of it will still be, because really with sparkling, the longer it sits, the better it is. But it's fun. And especially with like the weddings and a lot of the events we do, like everyone wants sparkling. It's a really fun project for our winemaker. So he loves being able to try different things like the Beaujolais or the sparkling. It's all these, like, not everything has to be totally commercially viable since we have a venue to sell it out of. So it gives him that ability to play around with different things.
What other, like, things are you guys playing around with?
We do, one of my favorite things we do is Riesling three ways. So Riesling is a really versatile grape. And we take Riesling, and we'll do kind of your classic stainless steel, fermented and aged, totally dry, so no sugar. Some people think that Riesling has to be sweet. It doesn't. But this one, it's kind of that Alsatian style of Riesling. And that's our largest SKU. So, like, that one we'll make the most of. But then we'll also make it where we actually age Riesling in a barrel, which is completely not done very much anymore. And we actually allow it to age in these super old barrels for like 2 years, which totally changes the wine. And then we'll do another version where we actually allow it to ferment with the skins. And there's this new kind of wine fat out there called the orange wine.
I was going to ask if you were going to
And it's not actually made with oranges. It's made where you kind of make a white wine the way you'd make a red wine. And the big difference there is you're allowing the grape skins to sit with the juices during the fermentation process. And some of the colors of those skins will actually come off on the wine. And even though white wine grapes have green skins, it actually forms this like orange color. And if you actually tasted this wine blind and you didn't know what you were drinking, a lot of people would actually think it's a red wine because it's taking a lot of those properties, the tannins and the flavors from the skins. So what we'll do at the wine bar is we'll actually have a flight where you can have all three of them next to each other. So in color, the stainless steel is going to be the lightest of yellow and then work its way up to the orange. And you try them side by side where it's the exact same grapes, same vineyard, same rows, everything. But this shows winemaking techniques and how you can take the exact same fruit and make three different types of wines. And that is a way to learn through tasting that we really love.
That's far out.
No, I totally agree. I could talk about this forever, Sarah.
I know. It's like your job.
Something like that. But we do have to take a break because my favorite part of the show is coming up, which is the morning after quiz. Mm-hmm. Brian, where can we... Where's the winery located specifically?
Sure. So the winery's at 213 North 8th Street between Driggs and Roebling in Williamsburg. And for those not in town, bkwinery.com has – we actually sell a lot of our wines through the internet, so you can buy them there. And hopefully you live in a state that we can ship to.
And if you don't, you should move.
Exactly. Or just come to the winery in Brooklyn.
Yeah, definitely. So we're going to take a break here on the morning after.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back here on the morning after. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
It is one of our favorite times of the hour. It is time for the morning after quiz. We've been speaking with Brian Leventhal of Brooklyn Winery. And Brian, yes, your name is Brian.
Yes.
But does that mean you know anything about Monty Python's legendary comedy film, Life of Brian? It's time for the morning after quiz. So I will ask you just a series, three questions, all multiple choice, A, B, and
okay.
C. Really no pressure, but no one's ever won before. For you and for our guests out there, I will briefly sum up the movie Life of Brian. It's the story of a young Jewish man named Brian Cohen, who was born on the same day as and next door to Jesus Christ. Yikes, right?
Pretty much your life story so far.
And then throughout the film, he is subsequently mistaken for the Messiah. So I'm sure you can relate.
I'm sure you get that all the time.
Every now and then.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Question one. Which Beatle funded, as in the Beatles, funded the production of Life of Brian after EMI pulled its original cash flow?
Interesting.
Is it A, Ringo? Is it B, George? Or is it C. Paul?
Very interesting. I'm gonna guess George.
Yes, right. It was George. Does he seem to be the one who would like be funding things like this and not focusing on music?
The way that I did this
music?
Was it was I used deductive reasoning.
Oh God, Beth.
Right. And
something we do not use here.
Uh-uh.
I didn't think Ringo could afford to fund the movie.
What? He was a Beatle.
I know, but like you look at like him now and you're like, I don't know.
He's the only one alive. Okay, yeah. Wait, no, I'm kidding. No. Paul's alive.
Oh, yeah.
And then for Paul, he's like such a big deal. This might go beneath Paul. So I was like, George is kind of in the middle there. So that's how I picked him.
All right.
I thought Ringo, I don't know. Is Ringo Jewish?
He does have a larger nose.
Starkey's his last
name.
I think he's Jewish.
Yeah, I think he's probably Jewish.
Yeah.
Here we go. Question two. Inciting controversy with its satire of religious themes, Life of Brian was banned in which of these three countries? Mm. Is it A, Norway? Is it B, Sweden? Or is it C, France?
Wow. All right, this one's going to be a complete guess.
Deductive reasoning.
I will say Sweden.
You say Sweden. B, Sweden is not correct. Oh. Actually, Sweden on all of their Life of Brian posters wrote, "So funny, it was banned in Norway."
Oh, I picked the wrong one. All right.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, it was actually banned in Norway and Ireland.
Really?
And for 10 years. So I think it was like 1979 when it came out. Yeah,
but
10 years later.
It's no longer banned?
No, it's no longer banned.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Here in 2015. Yeah,
that's
no
like
longer banned.
Policy that had to happen.
I would hope so. Yeah. I would really hope so. So, final question.
Let's
question three. In one of Life of Brian's most famous scenes, John Cleese's character asks his followers, it's kind of like a cry to war, cry to battle, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" To which his followers answer, like, at least 10 things. The Romans, like, they just list all of these things that the Romans have done for them.
Like infrastructure.
Like, because, I mean, the Romans were
they did
pretty significant conquering power. So which of these is not something the Romans did for us? Is it A, animal control? Is it B, wine? Or is it C, sanitation?
Threw wine in there, and that's interesting. Did the Romans do wine? They did. They did wine, but were they the first to do it? I don't think they. I don't think they were. I'm gonna go wine.
You're gonna go wine?
Yeah.
No, yeah. It's not. No, the Romans definitely did wine.
They did,
for them.
But they
yeah.
did. But I didn't realize
well,
it was like
no,
they were
I mean,
the
I think
first
it's in,
ones
it's
to do
in,
it.
They're not the first ones to do it. No, but I think it's in like within the idea of the Roman domination.
Animal control. What was it?
It was animal control. Yeah, that was my made up one. They can't control it. Yeah. I mean, I guess the way they controlled animals was like throwing them into the Colosseum and having gladiators fight them, right? With all the tiger problems they probably had back then. Anyway, thank you so much for playing the
thank
morning
you.
After quiz.
One out of three.
You know, I will admit I've never seen Life of Brian, so I probably wouldn't have gotten any of those right either.
That's all right. It's, Monty Python makes good movies. So.
Yeah, but I think we're all going to go on Netflix.
We're all going
right?
to have to see it, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
Brian Leventhal of Brooklyn Winery, thank you so much for stopping by the morning after.
Thank you.
It's time for us
thank
to eat
you,
some
Brian.
Pizza together.
Awesome.
Sari, I'll see you next week.
For show.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.